The Virtual Curbside is a production of the Utah Chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Utah AAP, working together to improve children's lives through education, advocacy, and networking. Hi, this is Paul Workus from the Utah AAP. Welcome to this week's edition of the Virtual Curbside, where we bring pediatric providers together with subspecialists to get smarter about all things pediatric and better acquainted as a community of caregivers. The Virtual Curbside is brought to you in part by a generous grant from Primary Children's Hospital. Primary Children's Hospital, the child, first and always. Welcome back to the Virtual Curbside. We are very fortunate this month to be talking about dental issues with Hans Reinemer. Welcome back, Hans.
Thank you for having me. It's been enjoyable.
Oh, it's been delightful to have you. As I said at the very first of all this, it's embarrassing that we haven't had this conversation before now. And I think the thing that you're arguing is the same thing that we should all be arguing, and that's we need more information about dental health, and we need better relationships with the dental providers so that we can collaborate in a meaningful way. I talk about that every month, that every person I talk to, I think, yeah, that's what's important. We need to collaborate. And then we end up in our silos. So thanks for talking.
Yeah, absolutely. Hoping I can contribute to all things dental health.
Yeah. Have you acquired any conflicts that you'd like to talk about?
No.
All right. Let's talk about some oral and dental emergencies. One of the things that you talked about at the very first is that one of the advantages of having a relationship, both for me and for my patients with pediatric dental providers, is that things happen. And it's important for us to be able to collaborate about those things. What are some of the most common dental emergencies that you are faced with?
Yeah, we see a variety of dental-related emergencies. And honestly, you know, we're asked to give a talk here at Primary Children's once a year. And I always ask for topics of interest. And almost unanimously every year, it's what do I do if a dental emergency shows up in my pediatrics office? Because, you know, the pediatricians are not always comfortable looking in the mouth, but what if a dental emergency happens? Then I really am up a creek. So they appreciate any information. So I would classify dental emergency in one of three ways. One, it could be a pathology related issue, something that just doesn't look right. You know, how do I identify what is not normal and what is normal? So something that's pathologically related. There could be a dental trauma of some sort. You know, a kid has fallen off a scooter and maybe they came into your office because they scraped their head or bumped their nose and they need you to look at it. But, oh, while we're looking here, I just noticed that two teeth are out of position. So what happens then? And then there could be some infection-related issues. Is it an odontogenic infection? Is it a viral infection? So pathology, infection, and dental trauma would be probably the most common types of dental emergencies that you would all face in your offices.
Let's talk about some of the common pathologies. What are some of the things that you see that we deal with?
Yeah, some of these, you know, I'll give you a few. Some of these are, you know, pretty basic, but these are the ones that, you know, we commonly see and things that are probably easily identifiable from your standpoint. So one of the things that we see commonly, and parents get pretty worked up about it, is a child in the, you know, 1 to 2.5 year old age range, they have erupting teeth, and there's something called an eruption hematoma. You can see these in the anterior region, but they're most common in the posterior region along the crest of the alveolar ridge, but it looks like a big bloody bruise of some sort. And so it looks kind of scary to an uneducated parent. But basically what that is just an erupting tooth that has yet to pierce the mucosa of that alveolar ridge. And as the tooth is erupting, it can create some bleeding submucosally there. So it kind of swells up. It could look sort of cystic, but it's red or purple or black. And the good news is on something like that, it's a peace of mind diagnosis for the parent. You just tell them this is a normal process. And then once that tooth kind of pierces the gingiva, and then the blood drains out of it, it's kind of normal. So that's called an eruption hematoma. That's a pretty common finding. Any sort of eruption pattern that's out of the norm, I would say. So this goes back to, I think we talked about this a couple episodes ago, but having a familiarity or access to a growth and development chart, knowing when are teeth supposed to come in, when are teeth supposed to come out? Because sometimes, honestly, in private practice, I think I got a call once a week about, oh my gosh, my child has two rows of teeth, right? And so what's the most common area is down here in the lower, in the front. Uh-huh. We call it shark teeth because it's, I don't know, it's kind of a fun thing to call it for the kid. But knowing that that's a normal process, you know, permanent teeth are trying to come in where baby teeth are. And so just providing some comfort to a parent that, you know, this happens sometimes, the baby teeth will fall out, the permanent teeth will kind of assume the normal position. So knowing what's a true emergency and what needs to be followed up by the dentist in terms of growth and development is common. And then I think probably the most significant new topic right now is lip or tongue ties. That's what a lot of parents are very familiar with nowadays.
Can you clear that up for us?
I wish I could, but the problem is there really is no evidence-based guidelines that are really significant at this point. And so I think, you know, for generations, I think we lived just fine with a lip or tongue tie. And I think nurses and the newborn ward used to just sort of take care of business with their fingernails, from what I understand, but that's not happening as much anymore. So the concern there is my child suckling? Are they able to latch, you know? And so this lip or tongue tie is an issue that's being, you know, made more aware. Now, not every frenum needs to be addressed, you know? So I think this is something that you're probably going to see. And I think an appropriate referral to a lactation consultant and then to a pediatric dentist to make sure that this is something that is significant, it should be addressed, or maybe it's not really contributing to the suckling issue. But certainly not every lip or tongue tie needs to be clipped. That's the concern. We want to make sure that we're addressing the problem and not over-treating kids at the same time.
It seems the concern about lip tie has blossomed a ton over the last while, and it almost seems to me that it's related to the fact that dentists have equipment for ablating the lip frenulum. Am I misreading that?
No, you're not misreading it. And I think it's unfortunate. So if you ever had a patient that was interested in having it looked at, I'm not going to say go in with being hesitant. I think it should be evaluated. But unfortunately, the evidence, in my opinion, if you look at the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry's updated guidelines, there are reasons to do it. But there are people out there that, unfortunately, that have the ability to do it very quickly, and they're doing it, in my opinion, too much. And so you just have to be a little careful. You can certainly over-treat kids unnecessarily.
One other thing about tooth eruption, it seems that one of the things that I get asked about a lot is there may be some irregularities along the alveolar ridge, a little cyst or something, and people assume those are teeth. They are generally not. The alveolar ridge can be a little irregular, right?
It's not uncommon to have little nodules or cystic looking things. There's a variety of names attached to those. Those are not pathological in a bad way at all. But again, having somebody take a look at that just to rule out other things, which are very, very rare, is important to do. But usually it's not a big deal.
And if a baby's born with teeth, when do you want to see them?
Yeah, so you can get natal teeth, which are present at birth, and you can get neonatal teeth, which are eruptions of teeth soon after birth. We need to look at those right away, actually. The reason for that is a lot of times these are poorly formed teeth, and they can be very mobile, so we're concerned about aspiration risk if they should come out. It also presents a potential problem for a nursing mother that may not always be very comfortable. So assessing whether or not these are the actual teeth, the level of mobility that could potentially be a concern with aspiration, and how the mom is doing with nursing. Sometimes we actually take these teeth out. Sometimes we allow them to remain, depending on how they look and the risk level.
If they're poorly rooted, poorly formed, is that usually the primary tooth, and then you're going to have to wait for several years to get teeth in that position?
Well, it can be. Sometimes it's not. It just sort of depends. And so,
That's why we call you, right?
So that's right. Yeah.
Let's talk about dental infections, because I think that's something that shows up, and I'm not always exactly sure what to do about it. How do you diagnose and manage a dental infection in a child?
You're talking specifically about a tooth-related infection?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So there's a variety of infectious processes that can happen inside the mouth. Most are going to be related to odontogenic etiology. So a cavity that is allowed to progress will ultimately invade the nerve of the tooth, the pulp. And then when that pulp space becomes necrotic, it leads to pain, swelling, infection. And so identifying infection and a child is related very much to the tooth. The good news is about a primary tooth dental infection is that any swelling that you see is usually immediately adjacent to the tooth in question. So as you're looking at a potential swelling in the vestibule of the mouth, for example, look at the tooth immediately adjacent to that swelling, and if you see a big hole, then you've identified your problem. These can be time sensitive. We don't want these to be allowed to progress, because if they're not dealt with in a time sensitive manner, they can progress to a more significant issue, which is, you know, a facial cellulitis, which we don't really want. So if you identify any sort of swelling adjacent to a tooth in the vestibule, a good course of action is just a timely referral to a dentist who can evaluate that with intraoral radiographs. And then treatment is usually a round of antibiotics and usually an extraction in that case.
So a patient who presents with jaw pain, in terms of sorting that out, is it odontogenic or not? Is my main clue is going to be looking for relationship to a tooth?
Yeah, what is the history of that tooth? Does the tooth look normal? Does it have a cavity? Has he had treatment on that tooth before? Because even if a tooth has been treated before, it doesn't mean it can't go south on you. So just getting a good dental history and then a timely referral is good. And then looking at the extent of the infection, if it seems fairly limited, it's close to the tooth, it's in the vestibule, you got a little knot there, you can feel rest assured that you've identified this in a timely manner. You can send him home with some antibiotics, get into the dentist, we can follow up and treat it. The concern then is it, having it not treated, and then the kid ends up with a facial cellulitis, and then that may be beyond going to the dentist. They may be referred up here to primary children's for admission and IV antibiotics.
Sure. One of the issues that we should probably take into account there is that, as with many other infections that are like abscesses or are abscesses, starting the antibiotic may be insufficient. So that's why we need to think of this as something that really requires definitive treatment. That's you, right?
That's right. Because the antibiotic may make you feel a little bit better in the short term, may actually make the swelling look a little bit better. But at the end of the day, it's not the cure. You have to treat the etiology, which is the cavity or the infection in the tooth. And so make sure that if you do send a kiddo home with some antibiotics, that they follow through with that dentist to get the tooth treated so that it doesn't come back, because the antibiotics simply going to be a band-aid in the short term.
So what other oral infections do you tend to see?
Well, an extension of what we've already talked about, and that would be the cellulitis and stuff. If a kiddo ever came in with a more significant facial swelling beyond the localized vestibular swelling adjacent to a tooth, then that's even more urgent. That needs to be referred up to the hospital. And what you're looking for there is swelling that affects either the orbit of the eye on a maxillary tooth. If you start getting closure of the eye, bruising around the eye, that's a concern. If you, on a lower tooth, if you get submandibular swelling or that affects the child's ability to swallow or open their mouth or causes swelling of the tongue, we're really worried about airway issues. And so if you see infection to that extent, you need to get them up here. And treatment there is usually a little bit more aggressive with intravenous antibiotics and incision and drainage. But then ultimately, we're doing the same thing with extraction.
Other infections in the mouth?
Yeah, I would say beyond bacterial origins, one of the common things that we see in, you know, the 2 to 5 year old age group is a herpes simplex infection that it causes a diagnosis of acute herpetic gingivostomatitis. And this is an awful looking thing.
No fun. Yeah.
And you've probably seen it. This is something that's caused again by the herpes simplex virus. And it presents as a kiddo with fever. You get ulcerations and vesicles of the gingiva and the oral mucosa. The gums are really just fiery red. They don't drink. They don't eat. They're up for a week. Mom's had it, you know. The good news is it's self-limiting, like every other virus. 7 to 10 days of palliative care, it goes away. But just assuring mom that it goes away on its own is the good news. But it can be really tough on a little kid. So just assessing that kiddo's hydration, make sure that they're getting enough fluid so they don't dehydrate is the key there. And just be patient, give it time, palliative care.
Clearly one of those two-part things where congratulations, you made the right diagnosis, but make sure that you still are caring for that kid's needs.
That's right.
Let's talk about trauma a little bit. I mean, kids are programmed for trauma and teeth are in the line of fire. So what sorts of things do you see? Let's talk about what happens to kids' teeth.
Wow, and it's kind of amazing. You know, we see a lot of trauma here at Primary Children's, and it's fascinating what kids can get themselves into. The stories behind some of these traumas are just kind of unbelievable and entertaining sometimes. But We see a lot of different types of traumas. And the most important thing, I think, for a healthcare provider to know that's not in a dental office is just know that a lot of these things are very time sensitive. When you traumatize a tooth, you have the possibility of exposing the nerve of the tooth, which then can be open to infection. And then you can damage the periodontal ligament, which is the ligament that holds the tooth into the bony socket. So as you're assessing these injuries, make sure that the parents understand that these are time sensitive. These are not life and death emergencies, but they're very time sensitive. The sooner that they can get into a dental office, the better the prognosis for some of these teeth.
Teeth can be repaired, right? Teeth can be put back in place, and that's important to remember.
Oh, absolutely. So for example, a fractured tooth, you know, kid falls down, fractures a tooth off. You know, that can be restored with a lot of our dental materials. We want to assess whether or not the nerve of the tooth has been exposed or not. If the nerve space has been exposed, that's what we consider to be a complicated fracture. But we want to be able to seal that nerve space up so bacteria from the mouth don't invade it, cause infection of the tooth. If it's an uncomplicated fracture, that means that the nerve of the tooth has not been exposed. But either way, we want to see that kiddo to make sure that there's no exposure to that nerve space, so it gives the tooth the best chance of survival. If you see a tooth that's ever been pushed out of place, that's called a luxation injury, and that can happen in almost any direction. Teeth can be pushed up, they can be pushed out or in, and there we're talking about damage to that periodontal ligament. That's the ligament that holds the tooth in the bony socket. And so maintaining the vitality of those cells is what makes this a time-sensitive scenario. So repositioning those teeth and stabilizing them gives them the best chance of success for sure. And then the worst case scenario, obviously, is the complete avulsion. You know, you've knocked a tooth completely out of the mouth. You know, how then do we assess and treat that as a real reason to get that kiddo into the office? And that may be something that pediatricians actually play a vital role in if that child shows up in the office, because getting that tooth back into the socket as soon as possible is really the best thing that we can do.
Let's talk about the time element. How much time do you have with a luxation? How much time do you have with an avulsion?
Luxation injuries are not, they're time sensitive, but not as much as an avulsion. Science shows us that within 30 to 60 minutes for a complete avulsion is really the critical timing element there. So if we can get a tooth back into the socket as soon as it comes out, the better. Up till 60 minutes, better prognosis, but much beyond 60 minutes, you still have a fair prognosis, but it just gets worse with every additional minute. So getting that tooth back into the socket is the very best thing that you can do. A good rule of thumb, though, for anyone treating kids, though, is that if a primary tooth is ever avulsed, those are never replanted. So we're talking specifically here about permanent teeth. Don't ever try to replant a primary tooth, because you're just going to add insult to injury to that developing permanent tooth. But gotcha. This is only permanent teeth.
When I get the phone call that someone has, you know, knocked out a permanent tooth, that's, for one thing, that's a real advantage if someone has a relationship with the dentist.
Right.
That both I and the patient have a relationship with the dentist, that we can coordinate that. And time is of the essence. So if that's not possible, I suppose an emergency department, but in some ways, getting them right into your hands is the best thing if 30 to 60 minutes is the issue.
Very best thing. So if you ever receive that phone call, the instructions would be, first of all, do you have the tooth? Hopefully, yes.
Yeah.
A very, very gentle rinse, a real gentle rinse. And then if you can, put the tooth back into the socket. We don't even care if it's front-facing or back-facing. Put the root in the socket, because we can fix that later. If you can get it in there, that's the very, very best piece of advice you can give them. If they cannot do that, then the appropriate storage medium as you're driving to the dental office or the emergency room is next best. And it's been demonstrated that a cup of milk, which most everybody has, is the best storage medium. So put it in a cup of milk. The very worst thing you can do is just keep it dry, because then those periodontal ligament cells dry out and die. So milk is the very best thing that you can store it in until you see somebody.
Perfect. Let's talk about something that we see. And when the frenum's in the mouth tear, they bleed a lot. Tell us about torn frenums.
Yeah, so soft tissue injuries in the mouth look worse than they actually are in many cases. So a young child running along, face plants, tears the maxillary frenum, for example, those things will bleed pretty extensively. But once you get them cleaned up, you recognize that it's oftentimes limited to that torn frenum, and it's really not a big deal. Very rarely, unless you've got other extensive intraoral soft tissue lacerations, do those things need to be sutured. So it's really just a matter of just getting hemostasis, encouraging the parent to, you know, keep a clean and other palliative care, and those usually heal up. But make sure that, you know, we're looking at the cause. So it's very important to ask good questions when you see torn frenums like that. We certainly want to make sure that this is, you have a good story attached to it. Usually it's just a kid running too fast, but you want to make sure as you're looking at any hard or soft tissue injury in a child, you want to make sure you're ruling out any potential child abuse issues here. If you don't have a good story or something's not adding up, it's really important to follow through with that. And going back to a torn maxillary frenum, especially as it relates to a non-ambulatory kid, you know, somebody that's not running or scooting along or riding a bike that has a torn frenum, it's almost impossible for them to have that type of an injury. So if you see a kiddo that's non-ambulatory with a torn frenum, that's a real high suspicion of abuse.
Any other particular patterns of oral injury that would suggest abuse?
Yeah, any injury that shows up that you just can't explain. You know, so if you have a dental trauma, for example, and there, again, there's no good story attached to that, soft tissue injuries that don't add up, bruising, petechiae of the soft palate could be indicative of forced feeding or sexual assault, things like that. You need to be aware of some of those things that just don't add up. Healthcare providers are probably very familiar with a 10-4 rule, and that's just bruising of, you know, the torso, ears, and necks. Under 4 years of age, or any of those types of bruising under 4 months of age. And so again, this is our world. And so when a kiddo comes in for a dental injury, we're focused on the teeth, but we're also looking at other areas of the head and neck, which is the most common region for abuse. And so no one should be ignoring some of the other bumps and bruises that we see associated with some of these traumas.
You mentioned a couple of weeks ago concerns about socioeconomic status with oral health. When should I worry that dental health is related to neglect?
Well, if you feel like you've provided the counsel, you've provided the education, and nothing happens as a result of that, that can be a concern. You know, then you have to decide, well, is this an access to care issue? You know, I've provided the resources, they haven't followed through. It could be an access to care issue. Maybe they don't have the ability to pay. Maybe they don't have the resources.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe they just don't have the ability to do what you recommended, even right, if they have the best of intent. And then you have to compare that to purposeful neglect, right? You know, I've told them they just don't care, right? And so that can sometimes be a hard thing to differentiate. But if you've provided recommendations and nothing's happened, the next appropriate conversation is, what is it that we can do as healthcare providers to help you to maybe help identify some of those access to care issues? Because sometimes they're just don't know what questions to ask or how to do the next step. Could be an education thing. And so just doing our best to identify and assist. And then if that still doesn't happen, then you have to consider, well, maybe they're just choosing not to. And then that's potentially a reportable event.
Okay. So all things told, what's the most important thing for providers of health care to kids to remember about dental trauma?
Just recognize that something looks different. So if you're faced with a situation where something just doesn't look right, just recognize the time sensitivity of many of our dental injuries. The prognosis for traumatized teeth is actually quite good if we can get them into the hands of a dental provider sooner than later. So even if it's nothing, getting baseline information so that we can assess down the road is beneficial. So the time sensitivity is really important. The neurovascular space of the pulp and then the periodontal ligament cells can go south on you pretty fast if you don't evaluate sooner than later. So those are the critical things. Just waiting on any of these injuries leads to a poor prognosis. And so hopefully, again, going back to what we've discussed before, it's just beneficial, again, one more reason to have a good dental home, somebody that they can call, somebody that you can assist get them to so that we can evaluate them sooner than later.
I mean, clearly one of the real advantages of having a conversation like this is that it makes us aware of the issues. What's the best way for providers to get to know other providers? I know we ought to have more mixers or something, right?
Yeah, more mixers, yeah. You know, what I did in my neighborhood, and this is, I think, how we came to know each other, was if you're a provider look around your neighborhood, look around your community and say, okay, I'm a pediatric dentist. Really, I would love to know other pediatric medicine providers in my neighborhood. Just go visit. You know, it's hard. It's really hard because if I walk into your office, you're busy. We all get it. But I just think making an effort to get to know each other is really beneficial for interpersonal, interprofessional relationships, but also, again, for the benefit of the kid. I think participating at some level, I'd love to see more multidisciplinary care conferences, education conferences, where we can collaborate more. And I think that that's happening a little bit more here in the hospital. We talk pretty extensively with pediatric medicine residents, and we plant that seed. We want them to know that, you know, we can offer them a lot in terms of some of the subjects that we've talked about. And hopefully when they get in their communities, like you said before, they don't get into their little silos, they make an effort. But it's just a matter of getting out there and recognizing what each other do and telling each other, what can I offer you and what can you offer me? And if we do that, I think the ultimately who benefits are the kiddos.
Right. You know, I think there's so much about the way we educate ourselves and get educated that makes us feel like we're supposed to be more self-sufficient. And clearly, I think the magic in taking care of kids is having good people to collaborate with. Thank you so much for talking to us this month. Let's not let it go another 4 years before we...
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Again, send your questions to questions@thecurb.com. We'll deal with those next week. For those of you who are regular listeners, please tell a friend about us and like us and subscribe, because we're very emotionally needy around here. Thanks, Elisa Stoddard, for making this sound like a podcast. And thanks, Janice, for listening. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks for joining us. We look forward to getting together again next time. The Virtual Curbside is available on iTunes or wherever you find your other favorite podcasts. Be sure to like us and subscribe. We want you to like us both because we're needy that way and because that will help other listeners like you find us. Check out our website, thecurb.com, for supporting materials, schedules, and other great stuff. The Virtual Curbside is an educational production of the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. The opinions expressed in this podcast, while carefully considered, are ultimately the opinions of the presenters and not necessarily of the American Academy of Pediatrics or our employers. And remember, the content of this podcast shouldn't be seen as a substitute for seeking actual personal medical care. If this is an emergency, hang up and dial 911. Otherwise, schedule a visit with a caring healthcare provider to try to get to the bottom of your concerns. None of this could happen without Elisa Stoddard, our extraordinary executive director of the Utah AAP. Many thanks to Tim Cosgrove for his help on the website and logo design, production design, and editing thanks to Phil Workus, who also composed the theme music. See you next time.
Yeah, not bad. 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 Yeah, not bad.